Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for joining us. New census data shows rural parts of Kentucky have declined in population while urban areas have gained. And that sets the stage for drawing up new legislative and congressional districts, as we hear from Capitol reporter Ryland Barton.
The sharpest drops in population were in far eastern and western Kentucky, while the increases were in central Kentucky, northern Kentucky, and along the I-65 corridor, including Bowling Green. With supermajority control of both legislative chambers, Kentucky Republicans will be totally in charge of the redistricting process for the first time in state history. But the shifts in population to more urban parts of the state could force Republican legislators to make tough decisions about consolidating rural districts in areas where they've gained influence in recent years. The new census data also shows Kentucky became slightly more racially diverse, though it still lags behind much of the nation and ranks as the ninth least diverse state in the country. I'm Ryland Barton in Louisville.
Redistricting can be life-altering. It can be that important to us as individuals, and that's why we invited Joshua Douglas, professor of election and voting law at the University of Kentucky, to interview Louisville attorney Dee Pregliasco, representing the Kentucky League of Women Voters.
Hi, Dee. Thanks so much for joining a conversation about this important topic.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, you know, we're talking about redistricting, a process that the Kentucky legislature is about to embark on. And let me just start by asking, why does the League care so much about the drawing of legislative maps?
Well, actually, through the National League, we've been involved with this since the early 2000s, but particularly after the lawsuit in Kentucky that finally resolved itself in 2012 and the new maps from 2013, what it really said to us is people need to be involved, communities need to be involved. So we have made it one of our signature sort of, should we say, educational pieces. And we think it's important that the voters choose their representatives instead of the representatives choosing the voters. So we should have been paying attention for a long time, but we are now and we're working on it.
So that 2012-2013 example you just cited, that was from the last round of redistricting. Of course, this happens once every 10 years after the census, when the census counts everyone in the country, and then states and cities have to redraw their legislative lines to ensure that each one has equal population. What specifically about that litigation that went to the Kentucky Supreme Court, which threw out the map, what really opened your eyes with respect to that lawsuit that you mentioned?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on, not the least of which is gerrymandering sort of became something that people began paying attention to, which is that the representatives drew the maps to fit themselves, not to fit the communities. So that's part of it. And they also drew them. And of course, both parties have been bad actors all over the country in this, and we're nonpartisan. But they were drawing these maps to protect themselves. They weren't drawing the maps to do what was best for the communities, and they were done basically in secret. That is, we like to say, you know, in the basement, a dark room in the basement of the Capitol, and they would not bring the maps out for anybody to look at them except for, at the most, maybe a couple of days before they had to vote on them. So for us, that was not a good process either, that these maps, which again, as you just mentioned, lasts for 10 years. Once they're drawn and if they're, you know, if they're safe, there's no litigation, then it's 10 years, you can't change them. So that, again, you know, for us that we thought people need to know what's going on here.
And one of the things that the map in the last round in, you know, 2010, 2011 that the Kentucky Supreme Court threw out was it changed the district numbers. So all of a sudden, a district, say, in Lexington, represented by somebody, that person had their district change. And all of a sudden, overnight, they were representing someone in northern Kentucky just by virtue of the map. And as I think you're pointing out, done kind of in the back rooms, that's pretty serious and pretty unfair. So let me ask you, as a follow-up to that point, how does this affect me, an everyday voter? I mean, of course, I study election law, but for the listeners, the everyday voters, how does this really tangibly affect them?
I think there's two major ways. One is how you get in touch with and what kind of real contact do you have with your legislator. And then the other thing is, and I've started saying this to people, what happens in Frankfurt, in other words, where the legislature meets, what happens there affects your everyday life, because the people that are elected there pass laws, whether it's taxes, things about education, health, economic issues, tourism, it doesn't matter what it is, the laws that they have passed affect every Kentuckian. So we should have the bigger say in who those people are, and that would come with what we call fair maps and the public having some input into these maps. And if I could give you a specific example.
Please do.
Hopkinsville is a very compact city. They have three representatives. So here's a place where it's not that huge, obviously. Hopkinsville is not that huge. I think it's about 18,000 people. It has three different representatives. So where your school is, where your house is, where your church is, where your business is, can all be in these different districts instead of your having one district. So for us, Hopkinsville should have had a say in how those lines were drawn. And that's happened in Lexington. It's happened in Georgetown. It's happened in Middletown here in Jefferson County. And people haven't got to have a say.
So, you know, the mechanics of redistricting seem really technical, I think, at least to the layperson. You've got – sometimes you hear terms thrown out like the efficiency gap or minority vote dilution or one person, one vote. How does the league relate this stuff to how people could actually have an impact? How can Hopkinsville have an impact in terms of the way the maps are drawn when we're dealing with these technical terms like efficiency gap and minority vote dilution?
Well, if you draw the maps and you don't protect incumbents, that, for example, for Hopkinsville would have been a very effective. In other words, when we redrew maps, and these are possible maps because the new data, the 2020 census data comes out tomorrow, and then there's some more that comes out a little bit later. But we use the old data from 2010, and we've drawn possible maps that they could have drawn for all over the state. Hopkinsville would not have had to have those three representative districts. But if you try to protect incumbents, if you try to protect your party people, which both the Democrats and the Republicans did the last time, then that's what happens. But because of the Voting Rights Act, you can still protect communities of interest, which includes a minority group, so that they have a chance to elect people that they want to elect and that they're not divided up. So they have so few people in, you know, a lot of different districts that they can't then elect the people that they want. And of course, one person, one vote should be critical, that all the votes count, and the equality issue is critical when these districts are drawn. And that's what happened the last time with the litigation. They went over the numbers trying to do what they wanted to do.
And let's just be clear that everyone understands one person, one vote generally refers to the concept that every district should have about the same number of people. And when you're talking about Hopkinsville having three representatives, what you're saying is that the city was broken up into three different parts. What mapmakers refer to this sometimes as cracking, where they cracked the districts, they cracked the city, that is, into different component parts. Whereas if you looked at the community of Hopkinsville that often has very similar interests in the entire city, it would make more sense to draw one district essentially around the city itself.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's say there's a Republican listening here, Republican in Kentucky, and you know, Republican side has the votes right now in Frankfurt to pass the best possible map to keep their side in power, right? I mean, politics is a zero-sum game, and it's often you talked about incumbency protection, but the reality is that the Republicans have the ability to draw the maps basically however they want. What arguments can you make specifically to Republicans to say, you know, no, this is wrong, even though it helps your side?
All right. There's several arguments. One of the first ones that we really say to them is because they've been very critical of us by saying, well, where were you when the Democrats were doing this? And what we have said to them is, all right, look, everybody should have been paying attention. We should have been paying attention. Everybody should have been paying attention. And so that we should have talked about this back when the Democrats were doing it for about 30 years. But now we know that you have the power. So you can seek revenge, or you can be the good guys and be the good government guys. In other words, everybody talks about what's good government and doing it right. And so we've been trying to sort of speak to their better selves, shall we say. And we know they have the power to do it. And here's the thing, not everybody's going to be happy. But again, what I say to them, like I would do to my clients when I was litigating cases as an attorney, if we can have our say before the judge, if people have their say, if they can speak up, have public input to the process and not in the dark room in the basement, then people, I think, accept things in a better way. And particularly within this, you know, everything's so politicized and partisanship is terrible, I mean, people getting along. We have a chance to actually have maps that we can live with for the next 10 years and do something about, you know, making it better for everybody. So that's the sort of approach that we have said. And then why should we, you know, protect incumbents? I had someone, actually a Republican I talked today, who said, well, you know, we don't like to do that. We don't want incumbents pitted against each other. And of course, my thought for that is competition is good. You know, we ought to have primaries and we ought to have lots of competition because that gets the ideas out. And that's what democracy is about, you know, talking about ideas, educating ourselves, and then making our selections for representatives.
And, you know, your response with respect to appealing to their better sides reminds me of the election debate we had earlier this year over the election reform bill, H.R. 574, which kind of gave a little bit or a lot to both sides of the equation in terms of increasing access with 3 days of early voting now, though, you know, lots of people, myself included, wanted more than 3 days. Three is better than zero. And on the integrity side, doing things like tracking every absentee ballot with a barcode, ensuring that you have an online system to request your absentee ballot, but that also means that it enhances the integrity. There are win-wins in this kind of discussion, and Republicans had the votes. They could have gone for the strictest form of photo ID in 2020, something I've written a lot about. They passed instead a milder form of a photo ID law, and the same goes with this reform bill. So I think part of your argument ties into what the state has actually had national exposure over with respect to, you know, even though you had the votes to do the worst possible thing for democracy, instead you did the better thing for democracy. What about Democrats? I mean, they feel like they're pretty much cut out of the process here. What's your message to Democrats about how to best influence what goes into the line drawings this year?
Well, one of the things that's happened is the Democrats and the Republicans all went to the National Conference of State Legislators Conference on Redistricting in Las Vegas a few weeks ago. And I think that's good. And so they can draw their maps. And I think what they have been touting is obviously some of what we've been touting, which is having an open process. Actually, two Democrats sponsored the bills that we supported back last in 2020 as well as 2021 to have an advisory commission. So I think they're listening to people and they're going to try their best to say, yes, some of us did bad things in the past, but let's make this good going forward. It's going to be hard, you're right, because they've got the votes. I guess, you know, one of my other statements to the Republicans is, okay, you have the power. How you use that power is really what's important if you want to think about what your history is going to be for the state and what you've done for the state. So is it going to be good power or is it just going to be roll over them power? So we're going to be having forums, Fair Maps forums all over the state. We had hoped that the Republican Senate leadership and the House leadership were going to have listening tours. They talked about that. They're not going to have them. I checked that out today. So we're going to have some Fair Map forums all over the state to get people educated and, you know, and understanding about why this process is so important.
So it sounds like your focus is mostly on the transparency of the process. I mean, will you be satisfied if they hold a bunch of meetings but still come out with maps that really entrench the Republicans' incumbents in power?
No, obviously we would be disappointed if that's what happens. Certainly having it transparent, though, I think is the right step and is a good step to take. And I think having it open like that, I think the chances of their doing 100% of terrible things wouldn't happen. So, you know, if we just get to cut down, you know, some in half maybe even of the terrible things they might do. The gerrymandering, obviously, that would have been a partial success. What we would still support is not only an advisory commission, but if we could get to an independent commission. But an independent commission for Kentucky would take a constitutional amendment, and we can only have so many each year. And so that's a much heavier lift at this time. But again, if things really go badly this time, I think the push for an independent commission might be helped.
Well, actually, that was going to be my next question, was about a truly independent commission like Michigan adopted and is using now, and a handful of states have independent redistricting commissions. You noted that it requires a constitutional amendment here, which is why you went for an advisory commission through the legislature. Do you see the long-term prospects of either the advisory commission or the independent commission becoming law in Kentucky anytime in the near future?
I think we would have a greater chance, at least at this time, to a possible advisory commission. We actually also worked to help sponsor a joint resolution to just say we're going to have an open, transparent process. But I think I think we still have our work cut out for us. And a lot's going to depend upon what do they do this time. I think that's going to, in many ways, tell us what we need to work on going forward. Fortunately, we'll have time because this won't happen again until 2030, but unfortunately, it means we'll be stuck with whatever they do for the next 10 years.
Yeah, and another important point is that, a gerrymandered map is not a map that is impossible to break, right? It stacks the game against the minority side. But massive turnout among particular kinds of voters can undo, at least in part, some of the harms from a gerrymandered map, although it makes it very, very difficult, which is to say another reason why individuals have to be paying attention and getting involved, because, democracy reform, in my view, I'm biased as a voting rights scholar, but I think it should be at the top of the issues that concern voters. One last question for you, Dee. People listening to this hopefully are inspired to recognize that this is an important issue that they should be paying attention to over the next few months. How would you like individuals to become involved?
Well, there's several ways. They can go to our website and certainly can educate themselves through that about redistricting. On our website, too, can sign a petition to we're going to send to the legislature. This is not one of those kind of official with legal, rules petitions, but to get the legislature to open up the process. And then obviously educate yourself about it. I can't emphasize enough that what happens in Frankfort doesn't just stay there. It affects all of us. So even I don't think I paid enough attention to Frankfort as much as I should have, because of what happens there does affect us. And that's how we've got to engage people. And they can engage themselves. Nowadays, of course, you can get so much online. Our website will take you to all kinds of pieces of information. There are all kinds of voting sites from all over the country, as well as gerrymandering groups. We're working with the Princeton Gerrymandering Project with ideas. So there's a lot out there, but we really do need to work on getting all citizens to pay attention to what goes on in state government. Local government, obviously, state government. I think everybody's been so focused on the national government the last 4 or 5 years. But we have to pay attention to our state government also.
And that's really such an important point, right, that this stuff matters. There's been so much discussion of voting rights in the media and the news. Here's where it actually, comes to fruition. Here's where we can actually make a difference in something structural that will affect our representation for the next 10 years. That website, by the way, is lwvky.org. Dee, thanks for all of your work, for the League's work on this vitally important issue to our democracy. And thanks, Senator, for spending some time.
Yes, and thank you. Appreciate your having us.
University of Kentucky Professor of Election and Voting Law Joshua Douglas, with Louisville Attorney Dee Pregliasco representing the Kentucky League of Women Voters. The U.S. Senate has approved something known around the halls of Congress as IJA,
That stands for Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. It was sponsored by Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio and Democrat Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. IGA provides $1.25 billion over 5 years, potentially, to complete the Appalachian Highway System. It's a network of roads and bridges begun in 1965 to connect some of the most rural and hard-to-reach parts of Appalachia. The measure now goes to the House, where it will be taken up in the fall. To wrap our minds around the implications of completing that highway system, we're going to turn to Brandon McBride. He's executive director of the Appalachian Regional Commission in Washington. Brandon McBride, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you. I'm happy to be able to join you.
And if we could, let's begin with a kind of nutshell history of the Appalachian highway system. What can you tell us?
Well, in the early 1960s, when President Kennedy was campaigning for office, he visited West Virginia, and he was struck by the isolation and how hard it was to reach certain communities because they did not have a safe network of highways and roads. And so after taking office, the president created the Appalachian Regional Commission to report back to Congress on things that would support economic growth in the region and find ways to overcome some of that isolation. Early on, the nation's interstate highway system had largely bypassed Appalachia, going through or around the region's rugged terrain, because they were looking to build the roads in the most cost-effective way possible. So the commission's report back to Congress recommended a modern highway system for Appalachia to help support economic development. And as a result of that report, Congress authorized the construction of ADHS in the Appalachian Regional Development Act of 1965.
And how much of that system has been completed so far?
As of fiscal year 2020, more than 2,800 miles have been completed. That's about 91% of the highway system that is either under construction or open to traffic right now.
Okay, and I understand that the parts of the system that remain to be completed are the most difficult and expensive. Is that correct? And where are those sections?
That is true, and they can be found throughout the region. Our cost estimate to complete the rest of the system is $9.7 billion.
And how would those funds be distributed?
Well, they're distributed through the normal federal highway system mechanism, and the funding goes to the state departments of transportation who prioritize corridors and look at the unfinished pieces of the system and prioritize those projects with the funding that is available.
Are you in a position to say now to what extent Eastern Kentucky would benefit from completion of the system?
Well, Kentucky's estimated cost to complete its remaining portion of the system is almost $172 million. So over the next 5 years, hopefully we would be able to make some progress with additional funds from Congress.
So let's talk about the implications of this. What are they? What are the implications of opening up ingress and egress to and from these hard-to-reach areas of Appalachia?
Well, in 2017, ARC participated in a study of the economic analysis of completing the Appalachian Development Highway System. And what we found was that there would be a return of investment estimated at 3.7, meaning that the present value of benefit is estimated to be $3.70 for every dollar that we invest in the highway system. And if we were able to complete the system, that would result in 78 million more hours of travel time saved, transportation costs, savings, and economic productivity gains would be $2.2 billion a year.
The decline of the coal industry in this region has left open how the region moves forward. Tourism, ecotourism in particular, is getting a lot of attention, a lot of talk around here. Access, of course, is key to that, but the construction of highways also comes with ecological and environmental consequences, which seems like a tough balance. In planning these highways, are those considerations taken into account?
Well, sure. We want to work with DOT and the state highway departments as we look at the portions of the system that remain to be built out and make sure that we're taking into consideration all the factors as you would in any other highway system as it is built out. So certainly that is something that we are mindful of. But to your point, there are a lot of opportunities from a tourism perspective in the region, and certainly that offers new opportunities for economic growth, and we want to be able to help communities take advantage of that.
That's Brandon McBride. He's Executive Director of the Appalachian Regional Commission in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And while we're talking about new highway construction, what about electric cars and trucks? A University of Kentucky professor of materials science says President Biden's aim to see electric vehicles hit 40% to 50% of vehicles purchased in the U.S. by 2030 is a tall order. But as Stu Johnson reports, he also sees great interest in a shift to electric among automakers and many U.S. consumers.
YT Chan says vehicles fully powered by electricity, fuel cell, or a plug-in hybrid sold in the United States last year represented 2% of the total number. So, to hit 50% in 9 years, Chan admits it's a tall order. While automakers appear ready to up their electric car numbers, the physics and astronomy professor says they're probably looking elsewhere for infrastructure support.
The government can do something that individual car companies cannot do. For example, to build the infrastructure, the charging stations of sufficient density all around the country.
Dr. Chen envisions 15-minute quick charges. He says the cost of battery manufacturing is already declining. Chen says the cost of maintaining all electric vehicles is less than gas-powered because there are fewer moving parts. I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
Coming up after the break, Kentucky in space and down to earth with Silas House as Dwayne Lundy's guest on our Depth of Field series. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Wendy Barnett with the Under Main Arts Minute, bringing you local and regional arts news and events. The exquisite landscape is currently on display at the UK Art Museum. This exhibition includes a selection of paintings, drawings, and prints that present the landscape as a source of inspiration and awe. It includes the works of Lena Tharsing, the Lexington-based artist whose landscape and still life paintings are often infused with a quality of transcendent light. The exhibition runs through September 18th. You can find in-depth writing about Kentucky and the region's arts and culture online at undermain.art. Subscription to Undermain's newsletter can be found on the website, and it's free. I'm Wendy Barnett with the Undermain Arts Minute for WEKU's Eastern Standard. Now, back to Tom Martin.
You've probably noticed a lot of space activity lately. Missions to Mars, billionaires racing to get into the business of space tourism and cargo transfer. Kentucky is home to more than 600 businesses involved in aerospace and aviation. Among them is a Lexington-based company, the focus of a recent Middle Tech podcast, whose producers from time to time share excerpts with Eastern Standard.
Welcome back to Middle Tech on WEKU. I'm Logan Jones, the co-host and producer of the Middle Tech podcast. And today's conversation is with Twyman Clements, who is the co-founder and CEO of Space Tango. So Space Tango is an awesome company located right in Lexington, Kentucky, that is sending automated science experiments up onto the International Space Station, working with companies like SpaceX and NASA. So this is going on right in downtown Lexington. And we pick up this interview right as Twyman is telling us a little bit about what Space Tango actually does and how they do it. One quick note before we dive in, we actually recorded this interview on location with Space Tango in their mission control room, so the audio is a little bit echoey, so please just bear with us on that. But we're excited for you guys to listen, and we hope you guys enjoy.
We're very much very early on in the history of this company and what we want to do. And I think as a society or as a nation, what is going to become kind of the space economy over the next decade? It's going to be pretty interesting to see.
Absolutely. So let's transition that into How do you describe what Space Tango does and what the mission of Space Tango is?
Yeah. So really what we're looking to do is utilize the unique environment of space, particularly microgravity, which we'll talk about what that is, as this new platform for research and manufacturing. And how we do that is we basically build with what's going on behind me. To utilize that takes a unique skill set. And a lot of that is automation. A lot of that is building equipment that can operate through a number of different gravity fields. So 1G, 3 or 4 Gs during launch, 0G for a month or two, and then a couple Gs coming back home. And that is really difficult to do for like a life science payload. if you're trying to keep a stem cell culture or a tissue chip or some other things like that alive. And so that's kind of how we accomplish that. But really what we're trying to do is build the equipment to utilize this unique environment to create products that obviously are for the betterment of humanity. And so like an analogy that we think about that we kind of communicate this to is, as you think about, you know, human history, every time humanity has really harnessed a new physics medium or environment, there's been technology has been based off that, and then there's been capital creation. So you can think about electromagnetism, which has created radar, wireless signals that have created really the digital world that we know today. Electricity obviously has created the modern world. Vacuum doesn't sound very difficult. Vacuum is just taking air or a medium out of a volume, but allows you to create refrigeration, which allows you to store vaccines or food or other things like that. And so gravity is just one of those mediums. I mean, we know it, obviously, and humanity knows it because it's the only force we've ever really known and interacted with. But when you remove gravity, it just creates a new platform, kind of a new, obviously, environment, literally, that things interact differently. And so you can use that to an advantage for layer deposition work, stem cell pluripotency, some of these other things that we'll talk about. And, you know, we really just are focused on working with our partners on utilizing this to create things that could never have been created. And it's a lot of fun because you're doing cutting edge science. You're working with great world-class teams, building stuff that, you know, the ideas are generated in this building, usually built downstairs, and then we get to watch them a couple of days later on the screens behind me. So, but that's really what we're, you know, what we're trying to do here. And for us, as we grow, we're trying to diversify those use cases, that what we kind of call applications, diversify those number of applications for kind of industrial uses, build the equipment to enable that, and then use or develop our own, the infrastructure that's being developed with it, whether it's a SpaceX or a Rocket Lab or all these other kind of infrastructure players, use them to really build out this ecosystem.
Yeah, we were here prior to this interview, and we got a tour, which was awesome. It was really cool to walk through here and look at what you guys are doing in this office right downtown Kentucky. And when you drive by, you'd have no idea.
Yeah.
Right? It's just such an inconspicuous building.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on right here in Lexington? That's what I was thinking when I left this place. And we were shown, you know, these cubes that you guys are building. So
yeah.
I want you to talk about those. And then earlier you mentioned, you know, microgravity, and talk about how those cubes are harnessing and allowing you guys to use this microgravity, as you call it, as a platform.
Yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting thing in kind of sales and stuff like that, because we basically develop, they're called cube labs, and basically all the photos you'll see, they're metal boxes on the exterior. And the reason they're built that way is obviously just for ease of the astronauts using them. Astronaut time is valued anywhere between $20,000 and $30,000 an hour, fully burdened. Now, obviously, we don't pay that. NASA pays that. But if you took the value of all their training and divided it in half. So we want to minimize astronaut time. So basically, we build these autonomous boxes that have an experiment. And if you're doing cell culture work, you're keeping a cell line warm at 37°C at body temperature. You're maintaining typically a gas concentration. You're feeding it with a media that typically has to be cold before it goes into the incubation part. Typically, they like to save the food after it's consumed, or the media called effluent to do analysis. Then you typically want to image that. And so you've got to fit all that in a box that goes in a bag or goes in a different locker, flies up, and basically just gets a power and internet connection, and then runs autonomously. And so it's that kind of autonomy, designing for that autonomy is the difficult part. And, you know, one thing that we really learned, and Space Tango, Kentucky Space, really got its start as kind of the maker movement was kind of hitting its peak a little bit, in the sense that it was when everyone thought 3D printers would be everywhere, and Lowe's and everything else like that. And Arduinos were really coming out. So you think, okay, I can put these three or four things together and create whatever. And we started there, but you quickly learn that making something that can work for 10 minutes is very different than something that can work for, you know, a month and be randomly powered off due to something and come back up. And so that was some of the stuff we had to learn in our early phase. But the cube labs are, for us, they're basically the experiment modules. So they look kind of boring on the outside, but there's a lot packed in on the inside. And something that we're trying to do with our media and our messaging is to show what's the complexity of what's going on those insides. But the other thing is, once you get in zero gravity, the best example best two examples of trying to design around are, one, bubbles don't sound like a big deal, but are a huge pain for us in fluid lines, because on Earth, there's density, and bubbles will float to the top of whatever vessel they're typically in. In zero gravity, there is no density. And so those bubbles don't go to where you think they're going to go. And so you have to be either clever about getting them trapped into high surface area energy areas to hold them so that they don't clog something. Or if they do clog something, getting them out of there one way or another. So bubbles are a big one. And then the other is heat generation, particularly if you have heat generation in space in a vacuum, it's all radiative heat transfer. But in the space station where there's air, basically heat just generates and creates a bulb of hot air. So you have to have, you know, kind of forced airflow. So there's all these different things that you have to design. It's on Earth, it's not on Earth, and it's back at the same time.
So one of the things that popped into my head when we were thinking about doing this interview and talking to you guys is the logistics of getting to space. You know, we're just now figuring out how to really perfect logistics here on Earth. You know, Amazon figuring out how to get a package from point A to point B. Talk a little bit about the logistics of getting one of those cube labs from Lexington, Kentucky to the International Space Station, because I know it's like you got to connect the dots of putting it on a SpaceX rocket.
Right.
Then you've got to actually get it on the International Space Station. And one of the other questions I have that kind of goes along with that is it as simple as just having the funding to do it, or is there a lot of regulation you have to go through? What does that part of it look like?
Yeah, so there's two answers there, almost three. So one is, how do you get something on a vehicle like that and use the space station? And this goes back and give credit to KSTC and Kentucky Space. How we got started was NASA was beginning to commercialize, kind of quote unquote, about 10 years ago. And the Kentucky Space and then Space Tango were able to get Space Act agreements, which are basically these agreements to say you can use the space station for commercial purposes to start to build companies. And if you think about a national laboratory, the space station is a national lab. There are other national labs, I believe Sandia, Oak Ridge, you know, mostly around kind of nuclear, that are, you know, government-only facilities that they have kind of opened up for commercial uses. So the space station is one of those. And so we got one of those, built a relationship with NASA to be able to even go to the space station. So that's kind of the first part. You know, the second part there is it's really the safety verification and planning. And so we have an office in Houston, Texas, just across from the Johnson Space Center, that does a lot of that. So we say, and I'll use the mission that's kind of going on behind me, SpaceX 21, as an example. All right, we're going to fly a tissue chip system. That's going to take 6 to 12 months of coordination with NASA, because it needs to go up in a powered locker. It needs to be moved fairly quickly onto the space station, plugged into data, plugged into the power and data of the space station. It needs to run for a couple of weeks. It needs to then be moved to a freezer. That freezer needs to be moved back into the Dragon. It needs to come home. And so it takes a lot of that coordination. And there's systems built up that were moved from the space shuttle onto the space station that are how you kind of track all that. But it takes a lot of coordination, because everything is obviously to the millimeter and to the gram of what's up, what's in there and what's not. So there's a process there. And then there is the kind of the last part to that is the actual, like, physically taking the thing. So there's a lot of engineering design, prototyping and things like that. And then to use the tissue chip example, we go down to Cape Canaveral. We actually have laboratories about 4 miles from the launch pad. We load the cube labs actually in sterile biosafety hoods, because, you know, they have to be done sterile so we don't get any infection, bacteria or virus infection of the samples. They're typically locked. We typically close them up about 24 hours before launch. They go into the facilities about a couple hours after that. We do a final wait and CG. And then this last mission, just using it, me and another employee actually had to go out on the crew arm and get to put it into the vehicle, into the capsule, and check it out and everything else like that, which was as cool as it sounds.
I'm sure.
So that was like 12 hours before launch, and then they close up the door and it launches. So hopefully I haven't scared anybody off in that whole process. But it you know, sum it up, it's a lot of work. It's fun to watch the process and understand the process, so that as we design things, we get smarter about it. And certainly learn from it. But as I was telling you all before this got started, that mission, SpaceX 21, will be coming home in a couple of days. And basically, we'll be getting that hardware back, breaking everything apart, taking the samples, sending them to customers all across the country, and then bringing that hardware back here and recycle it for the next flight. So
if you enjoyed that conversation, you can find the full interview on the Middle Tech podcast feed on your favorite podcast streaming app, or you can go to middletechpod.com to find it there as well. For WEKU and Eastern Standard, I'm Logan Jones, co-host and producer of the Middle Tech podcast. Thanks for listening.
What makes Silas House tick? How does this celebrated Kentucky novelist go about writing those great books that often serve as a voice for Appalachian Kentucky? And where does the work intersect with activism? Dwayne Lundy gets into House's head in this latest episode of his series, Depth of Field.
Silas House, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You're obviously one of the most profound writers in you know, the Appalachian community, as well as the South. What is it from you in explaining what it's like to be here? I've had to answer that question many times. You know, why do you stay there? You know, I'm a music producer. You know, wouldn't it be an easier route for me to go to New York or Los Angeles or even Nashville? And I have my own personal reasons why I've stayed here. But I'm curious, from somebody that, you know, has such a voice and puts so much of their work is based in this, you know, geographical scenario that we're in, what do you want people to know about this area that you're proud of, that you know, may or may not show up in your work?
I think the thing for me is, you know, when you're from a place, I think if you're honest about it, there are things you love about it and that you hate about it. So there are definitely things about Kentucky, Appalachia, that deeply trouble me and that I think we could change. I think the thing that really troubles me is that people from outside the place get the issues wrong. Like, you know, they think it's all about that people here can't read and write and everybody's lazy and, you know, all these real antiquated notions. That those are not the real issues in the region right now for me, you know.
Right.
They just make me want to roll my eyes, you know. It really negates all the other great things about the place that I love so much. You know, the way people interact, the way the food ways, the landscape, the culture is what I love.
I'm always interested in writing, and I find it very intimidating, whether it's writing a song or a commissioned piece. Can you give me a little bit of an insight as to sort of how you prepare yourself to not only do it, but your day-to-day operation? Is it something you do consistently or visit occasionally?
Well, it's always intimidating for me, and it's intimidating like all the years that I'm working on a novel. My last novel, I worked on it about 8 years. I sort of think of it the same way as I think of stage fright, you know, and how stage fright gives you that great little boost of adrenaline that you need. But for me, it's a matter of just sustaining myself over the course of writing it. And so I feed off every kind of art that I can. And the big one for me is music. And that's why it shows up so much in my work, because I'm drawing on it to get through the work. I read a lot of poetry. I look at a lot of photographs. I watch a lot of films. I go on a lot of walks. Walking is probably the biggest thing that sustains my writing, and it's the thing that I encourage everybody to do.
I find it interesting that you are as influenced by outside art. I you know, I've talked to many people about this, and it's very sort of divided. Some people have to completely escape it and get away from anything, any outside influence.
Like, I wouldn't probably watch a film that is about the same thing that I'm writing about,
mm-hmm.
but I would watch a film and think about it tonally, the way that the film looks, you know, the way the characters are being created. I'm sort of looking for really great art that makes me want to create something good.
I met you and became aware of your work sort of a little bit later than I probably should have, through Ben Solee and Daniel Martin Moore and Jim James, who I had the privilege of working with on an album against, you know, mountaintop removal. Activism is a big part of what you do. Was that a conscientious move, or was that something very organic? And what have been the effects, both positively and negative?
Well, in a way, I feel like it was organic, in that ever since I was little, I always really had a need to, I couldn't be quiet about something that I felt was unjust. And I think that was mostly because my parents were that way. they did a lot of work in the community of just taking care of children who needed taken care of, raising cousins, but also speaking out when things weren't right. I really got involved in activism. I had written a book called The Cold Tattoo, and it explores some environmental issues. It's about two sisters fighting to keep their land from a coal company. And one day, Wendell Berry called me and said, you know, you're writing about all this stuff in your novels, but you're not doing anything, you know, and just really put me on the spot. And I'm so glad he did. Up to that point, I thought I can write about this. And I still believe that there are many different ways to fight back. You know, not everybody has to be out in the streets. There are quiet ways and there are loud ways and everything in between. But for that moment for me, I think it was important for me to speak up, especially because I'm from a coal mining family. And people in the region saw most of the environmental activists as outsiders who had no real stake in Appalachia and no stake in the coal mining industry. Whereas I could really tell a story about being from a family who had been able to come up out of poverty because of coal. You know, my grandfather lost his leg in the coal mines and went back to work in the mines. And it just gave a real complexity to the issue, I think, to be able to talk about it in Eastern Kentucky, especially, or, you know, within Appalachia. The best part for me was just when people would come up, you know, after we would have town halls and things like that, and just invite people to come in and tell their stories, whether they were pro or anti mountaintop removal. We just wanted to hear people's experiences. Please tell our story. We need you to tell our story, and you're able to get it in the newspaper, on the radio or whatever. And being able to do that really meant something to me, because I came from people who my whole life, you know, my whole childhood, I heard about how they didn't have a voice. They weren't given a voice. It was the first time I realized that I had some little bit of voice that could be heard in that way.
But this is only song. It can't change the world. This is only a song. It can't change the world. This is only a song. It can't change the world.
You wrote a play and a story, This Is My Heart for You, and yeah, that obviously has a very personal touch to it. Can you give me a little insight into when you sat down to write that? Was that something you feared, or did you feel empowered?
Well, writing This Is My Heart for You was a whole different kind of activist writing for me. I was commissioned to write that by Berea College. And basically, you know, I was told I could write about an issue that was going on. And so I thought it was going to be about mountaintop removal. They wanted it to be like an Appalachian issue. But it turned out while I was writing the book, there were these series of hate crimes that happened. There was a young man who was beaten nearly to death in Harlan County and managed to jump over a cliff and get away from the people who were beating him. It was the first federally prosecuted hate crime in the United States, turned out to be. They weren't charged. They were, you know, acquitted. There was an interracial couple in Pike County. A church wouldn't allow them to be married in their church because they were an interracial couple. There were lots of things that were happening in Berea where our students were having people throw water bottles at them from moving cars, and people's houses being spray painted, and a lot of stuff with the Confederate flag. And just, it seemed like all this stuff was really boiling up in the summer of 2011, which I can now see as a real prelude to what was going to come later. The big challenge there was trying to find the human story and not just make it a series of issues. I centered the whole play around what I felt was the most emotional thing that happened that summer, was a young gay couple was kicked out of the Hazard City pool by a manager who was quoting scripture to them. And of course, this was problematic mainly because it was a city-run facility, and here, you know, they're being run off with Bible verses. And so the whole thing sort of revolves around that and gives it a real emotional weight. But I knew that my family would know about the play, and I was still going through a lot of real battles with them after having come out. And so it was much more personal to me than anything that I had done before as a form of activism. I really felt like I was putting my relationships on the line with my family. But, you know, as if you're going to participate in art in any way, you just have to be true to the piece of art. You can't worry about other people or it's lame art.
Do you remember the moment when you realized that Silas House was going to be a published writer and that this was going to be your life's work artistically as well as professionally? I'm always interested with people when they realize that that moment has happened, and it's never the golden ticket moment that everybody thinks that it is. But do you remember that point of, you know, and I guess it could go along with even validation as opposed to just strictly a professional narrative on that?
Great question. I don't know that I can pinpoint a moment like that. You know, I mean, I think it happened in increments. And I know that when I first got an agent, I thought, wow, you know, I can't believe this is happening. And then when the agent called me and said, we've sold the book, I couldn't believe that either. But at the same time, I also didn't think, oh, now I'm a writer and everything has changed. I was just surprised. And then when my first book became successful, I guess the main moment for me was when I was able to quit my job as a mail carrier. And I knew that I would be able to support my family as a writer. But I've never, I mean, still, after 7 books, I always think, this next book get published? I don't know.
Right.
You
know? Yeah, I understand that all too well.
I also have quite a bit of imposter syndrome, which is very common among people raised working class. If I'm in a literary gathering or anything like that, I always sort of have this idea that they're just telling me that my work is good and they're just being polite and I'm only there to meet a quota or something like that, you know? Uh-huh. So that's a big part of.
Well, I think people in many facets of life can understand that feeling, you know, whether it's not feeling included or somehow you've conned your way into a situation that you don't belong in and you're wondering, am I supposed to be here or not? What's on the horizon for you?
I have a new novel coming out in fall of 22. It's a really different book for me. It's mostly set in Ireland, and it deals quite a bit with climate change and climate refugees. But thematically, it's also very similar. All of my work ultimately is about created family, blood family, trying to figure out your identity, things like that. So thematically, it fits right in with the rest of my books, but geographically and all that, it's going to look very different.
Well, Silas, I really appreciate your time. It's a joy to talk to you both on a personal level and about, you know, your creative process and, you know, much success to you in the future.
It is always great to talk to you and to see you, Dwayne. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. We'll talk soon. Thank you so much. I'm Dwayne Lundy with Depth of Field on Eastern Standard.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Music for Depth of Field by Ben Soley. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest an interview or a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.